session of the Whether We Live or Whether We Die series, and this one today will particularly be, it'll be a little bit of a wrap-up, so I'd like to get, you know, some stories from you, but also working somewhat with the four things that matter most that Ira Byock has identified for end-of-life situations. So it should be a good session together, I hope. We'll share a lot. I want to begin with a poem, as I have each day. This one is called Morning Song by Marsha Brown. Here, I place a blue glazed cup where the wood is slightly whitened. Here, I lay down two bright spoons, our breakfast saucers, napkins, white and smooth as milk. I'm stirring at the sink. I am stirring the amount of dew you can gather in two hands, folding it into the fragile quiet of the house. Before the eggs, before the coffee, heaving like a warm cat, I step out to the feeder, one foot, then the other, alive on wet blades. Air lifts my gown, I might fly. This thistle seed I pour is for the tiny birds. This ritual for all things frail and imperiled. Wings surround me, frothing the air. I am struck by what becomes holy. A woman who lost her teenage child to an illness without mercy said that at the end, her daughter sat up in her hospital bed and asked, "What should I do? What should I do?" Into a white enamel bath, I lower four brown eggs. You fill the door frame, warm and rumpled. Kiss the crown of my head. I know how the topmost leaves of dusty trees feel at the advent of the monsoon rains. I carry the woman with the lost child in my pocket, where she murmurs her love song without end. Just this each day. Bear yourself up on small wings to receive what is given. Feed one another with such tenderness it could almost be an answer. I'm going to read that last stanza again. I carry the woman with the lost child in my pocket, where she murmurs her love song without end. Just this each day. Bear yourself up on small wings to receive what is given. Feed one another with such tenderness it could almost be an answer. So those of you who have come in the later, I'd like to make sure that everybody has a copy of this spiritual care at the dying. Are there people who don't?
Thank you.
Someone there. Go up there.
Papers.
Yeah, so a couple more, maybe in case anyone comes. comes in. I think he has more than one.
Yeah.
All right.
Can I be the lady?
Oh, there you are. Great, great, great. Okay. That's a great one. I want to use this sort of as our primary text today. As we think about what it is that people need at the end of their lives. And this piece, the first couple of pages, page and a half, were written by someone who did not die, but came close and shared what his what he learned from that, in full expectation, of course, that one day he will die. And it comes from the hospice site. There are so many good resources out there for us to explore should we want to. And the hospice site is just full of great materials just for the asking. So I would really recommend that to you. But I think I'd like us to read this together, and would ask if someone would read that first paragraph, starting with "When you get ill."
When you get ill and are told you are going to die soon, needs come crowding in on you, jostling for scarce time and often scarce energies. So they in turn create their own need, a need for people and places to help you answer your needs. New needs then spring up as you begin to grasp the imperatives of dying.
Someone else take the next paragraph.
I was declared to be dying and did not. I experienced the needs and the challenges and lived to reflect on them.
Next.
My position is odd, not unique, but privileged. I was declared to be dying and did not. I experienced the needs and the challenges and lived to reflect on them afterwards, a temporary reprieve of unknown duration. Those needs and challenges have not gone away, but I can now look at them with some benefit of hindsight, so I could sum up the needs of one person diagnosed as close to death, me as being. Do you want me to continue?
Well, let's just take each one of these at a time. Maybe let's just sort of go this way now and kind of do it one by one. The need to settle up with the people that I felt close to so as to die in peace with them and with myself. And
the need to have someone to stand in for me, to do what I could not do when I became helpless or consigned to the grave.
Okay.
The need for places and organizations that I could turn to for practical information.
The need for someone to guide me or to go with me around this new and unfamiliar domain of the terminal state, not necessarily the same someone for every sector of it.
And finally, the guides and other special people who might be needed along the way, in addition to the financial and emotional advisors described earlier. I needed one, someone or somewhere to talk about death. Two, someone to tell me I am still beautiful. Three, someone who would help to restore my hope within the context of realism about my situation. Four, someone to forewarn me and teach me about the stress of my illness upon others. And five, and this is the one that I'm really quite interested in for each of us. Someone to recognize and encourage the emergence of that new alternative person that might never have been born without that illness and diagnosis. Someone who will teach me to understand the power of the ill person, both over him and or herself and over others, a power to be used wisely and humanely. For it can be, if misused, a tyranny, both over oneself and over others. Does that paragraph make any sense to you? Can you imagine a situation of someone using their illness, their final illness, in a way that was healthy and helpful to others, and then in a way that maybe was kind of tyrannical, or more as a weapon? Yes.
Yeah, I found a situation like that. I had a friend in Fort McMurray, Alberta, who knew me from way back, and then had a friend that she was running with and had throat cancer, went into the hospital, and this friend of mine contacted me and said, "Will you be her friend in the process of her dying?"
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of that new person in that situation.
Oh, so a new person could come in. I see, you're thinking especially that another person could come into a company that you have yet to meet.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
right.
Yes,
yes. Right, so that's definitely the case, that as one comes into these last weeks, days, whatever, months, there will be people who come into your life and will help you in ways not necessarily the people you expected. Sometimes the number of stories of in a sense, a kind of just an expectation that was disappointed when the person dying thought that so and so would be there for them and wasn't, and yet almost always there was someone that was some surprise person that stepped in, and it might even be someone on the medical staff who begins to serve that purpose for you as a kind of guide, a companion, someone with whom you can really be yourself, someone who has time to listen, all of those things that are needed, and which the person that is closest to you or the person that you expected to be your support may not have the capacity to do. So don't be harsh, too harsh on the people who don't come through that you had hoped would or expected would. We're all on this journey that of different growth rates, So it may not be the one that you most expected or wanted.
That's right. In that situation, she came from a very hurtful background within her church.
Uh-huh.
And so she was very bitter towards the church.
So it needed to be someone outside, possibly.
And see, for me to step in mm-hmm. as a stranger, mm-hmm. to break the ice and to take on the burden of grieving with her, mm-hmm. that church wasn't there for her, mm-hmm. and that perhaps someone else could be there for her in its place.
Thank you.
What you're saying is true even when a person is not in a terminal state.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's right,
you may
yes.
expect of your spouse to console you or something, and they may not be the person to do that.
They may not be. And
it's
that's
not,
the time
not
to remember
time
the...
To,
I'm sorry.
It's not a time to get them to do that. It's a time to find out who can.
Yes, right. Don't spend a whole lot of energy trying to get that person to do what you want them to do, maybe, but find the person who can. And remember the communion of saints. I think of that so much in terms of belief. I mean, I sometimes think, okay, I really can't believe this for a while right now. Will you believe for me? And then maybe later when you're unable to believe something, I'll believe it for you. But the same way in terms of what our needs are, as common human beings, certainly as church, that we can expect and will most likely receive from someone what we need.
Often, you know, the spouse or the child they have their own problems dealing with it.
They are grieving.
They're really grieving, and they can't
anger,
be
resentful,
support,
whatever.
Because
yeah,
they need support.
Yeah, yeah. And hopefully the time will come where there is a crossing back together, you know, where you can intersect again. But it may not be right at the moment that you feel like you need that support. So the other thing that he's saying in that number five is the emergence of the new you.
You.
Right. You know. And to welcome that, to look for that. The new you that wouldn't have been there if the illness hadn't come. You kind of find out some things about yourself.
And on that one, I like it that he's acknowledging, he or she's acknowledging, in that new person, it could be somebody, either the tyrannical sort who, I'm dying, why aren't you helping me, or the, I'm dying, but encourage it. I mean, the people who die in such a way that you feel everybody around them thinks, boy, are they wonderful. And to somebody to be there to say, you know, you're developing a new personality as you're dying, and helping you, he or she wants them, help guiding them to be the good kind rather than the...
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Most people do go through some fairly dramatic changes in who they are at the end of their life, and particularly if they're at the end of a long life and have gone through diminishments of various sorts or changes. So you really are probably dealing with some of that all the way along as family members. Now, for yourself, I don't know, you know, when you yourself realize that you are diminishing, or things have changed for you, things you could do before you can't do any longer, or things you could hold on to in terms of learning you can't hold on to the same way you could before, various changes, maybe you're finding yourself more patient or less patient, all these things that happen to us and changes that occur, there is a kind of new emergence of someone, and it's just to acknowledge that that's part of what your task is, to work with that. I want the material that's right underneath there is some of the stuff I went over the other day, but it's there for you to look at in terms of changes, some of the changes that happen as people come close to death. But I'd like to bring your attention to the back page now. And on some of these, this is some of the work that Ira Byock has done, and he's head of palliative care at Dartmouth Hitchcock Hospital in Hanover, New Hampshire. After the hospital was in Lebanon, but it's associated with dark condition. Yeah. And he has come up with these four things that matter most. And it's a wonderful book by that title. It's in the bookstore under the teaching staff recommendations, that sort of that covered that as you're going at that bookshelf. They're very, very simple things that people need to be able to do at the end of life. The first is to be able to say, "Forgive me." Is there someone in your life that you need to ask forgiveness from? This is a real question. Is there someone in your life that you need to ask forgiveness from and have not done that adequately? To have something unforgiven is this is real work. This is real work. Forgiveness at the end of life is real work. The other side of that is, I forgive you. Forgiveness, for anyone who has experienced that, is life-giving. it's as good for the person that gives the forgiveness as for the person who receives it. And sometimes you don't have control over whether the person is going to receive your forgiveness. But you do have control over forgiving that person, forgiving a person. So being able to do this and offer that, hoping the person will be able to receive it. But this is something you can do even if the person's died. Say you had an abusive parent. Say you had a terrible divorce. Or someone died on you. And you're still not reconciled to that. It's a lot of work that might remain yet in your life to be addressing. And it's extraordinarily important work that if you don't have a chance to do it, makes leaving this life harder. I mean, sometimes it can't happen, but when it can, it's wonderful. So these two things are very two of the four that he points to. The third is thank you. Being able to say thank you to the people who have meant so much to you in your life is a huge gift to yourself and to them. Huge. I want to tell you about this wonderful experience I had with a woman who was not in our congregation. In fact, she was really still a seeker. She was in her 60s, late 60s. Had been in the church sort of as a child, but then had not been for years, but had always been sort of spiritual and seeking of meaning in her life. And she received a diagnosis of a cancer that was quite aggressive, terribly aggressive, in fact. Her expectation, they had asked what they might expect in terms of time she had left, and were told that it was probably about 3 months. And she called, or one of the congregation members who was her friend asked her if she'd like to speak with the pastor, and she ended up calling. And I was able to meet with her and with her family members at a couple of times over the course of the time she had left. But she was very clear in her mind that what she wanted most was to gather her family together to thank them, and wanted me to facilitate that. And so she set a date that this was going to happen and arranged that her family members who were in Colorado could come, that as many as could possibly gather at that time. They all took a week to be there, at least a week to be there together with them. Some of them, they didn't stay in the house as they normally did, just to kind of keep it, keep her space quiet. But they were there. And I came for the for this gathering, this thanking time. And she sat in her chair. She was all dressed. They had set up a table of lovely kind of finger foods, champagne, you know, lovely things over there in this home. And she spoke then to each person in the room, thanking them for what they in particular had brought into her life. And after she was finished, then each of them responded, and as well as they could. Some of them were children, you know, some were her children, her spouse, her husband. And they all had this moment of being able to really appreciate one another and to give thanks for the really wonderful life they've had together. Not simple, not easy, but good. And then she stood up. You know, and this woman was, you know, I thought she was dying, you know. So she stood up, and then we went over and we ate, and she picked up her plate and got her food and ate her favorite things and sat down again. And they, you know, made plans for some of the remaining time that people were going to be there. And 2 days later, she had a huge downturn and died within 5 days. And it was more like 5 weeks that she had rather than 3 months. I mentioned earlier how doctors often do overestimate the time that you have left. And so I think that's just important to realize that may be the case, that you have less time than you think. And the fact that she had been able to gather, that she had decided this is what I want, and that she had had that chance was hugely important. It's going to be a memory that she gave to her family to hold on to and to be there with her and not have this all happen just at the funeral. You know, everybody talking about the things that they are so grateful for. That's what it needs to happen there too, for sure. You know, but that she could actually hear some of the things that people had to say about to thank her. So I would highly recommend that to any of you if the opportunity presents itself to gather together for a Thanksgiving service. It would be somewhat comparable. We did that little prayer of commendation. Some of you were part of that earlier in the week. It was that sort of a thing, but it was more just informal and family oriented, or you could do both things at once. The last one, and this happened a lot at that service as well, was I love you. I love you. We never get enough of that. People telling us that. And I know, you know, I talked to my 89-year-old father on the phone and I started saying I love you at the end of the time. He says, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, talk to you again. Well, you know. And that's I don't think he'll ever say it. I don't think he'll ever say it. But at least I'm saying it. Okay. And I know he loves me. I do. It'd be nice to hear it, but anyway. That chance, again, to say I love you to someone, to everyone, you can, probably. But there may be, in particular, people who need to hear that a lot. And all of these things, then, are part of what can lead you to be able to finally say goodbye. All will be well. Goodbye. Does anyone know where that word comes from?
God be with you.
God be with you. Yeah. Yeah. Nice to remember that. So, any stories that any of you would like to share about any of these potential opportunities, difficulties, how you could imagine them working out in your life or with people you know?
I have a question. I have a difficult person in my life I've done this with, and I feel very at peace as you can, but they're still alive. So do you assume in death that you do a do-over because they're somehow different, or do you do it over for you, or that confuses me?
Okay, so when I was speaking about if there was some forgiveness one needed to take care of for someone who'd already died, you mean that, or what? If you knew you needed to forgive someone, ask forgiveness of someone who had already died, is that what you mean?
No, that wasn't clear. I have somebody in my life I've done this with on some difficult things. They're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very at peace with how the situation's been handled.
Okay.
But like you were saying, if you say, forgive me, I forgive you, thank you, I love you, you may or may not get it back. So if that connection...
When you don't get it back.
Yeah, if that connection didn't happen in life after...
Oh.
Do you assume the person somehow as they approach death is able to do it again? Or do you say, you know...
Oh, surely hope
with,
that.
Or is it sort of forcing... that to rehash that, you know, that's my question. Is it sort of rehashing, or is it a gift, or is it a pounding on? You know what I mean?
So you're wondering, since you've already done this work with someone, when that person comes to die, or when you come to die, might you need to go over that again?
Yeah.
Because you aren't sure that it was responded to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I would, if it was something you felt you needed to do, in either case, again, I would follow that intuition that you feel that it's not finished. Something's still not finished here, and you will try to finish it still. And if you can't, then let it go. You've sort of done what you can to try to set that at rest. So I just go on how you're feeling at the time. Is it needed or not?
Both my parents died overnight at separate times. There was no time to say goodbye or even think they were dying at 56 and 62. And there was a lot of unhappiness in my childhood. But after about 5 years of counseling, which was marvelous, I finally started to understand where they came from, which helped me.
Mm-hmm.
My father had been in World War II. I didn't know what he was like before that. He was physically and mentally abusive to me. And I thought, he came from a wonderful family, from Breckenridge, Minnesota. And I just never understood how he got there. Well, Ken Burns had this wonderful series called The War. And my husband and I watched it, and it was like a light went on, because something happened. And whether it did or didn't, it made sense to me, and so I finally forgave him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm
so there's a lot, and I did a lot of writing too, which has helped.
Yes, the writing, as I mentioned earlier in the week, if there are those kinds, writing letters to people who've died, you know, that forgiveness, maybe if you've got some unfinished business with somebody, writing a letter. It's therapeutic. I think it can also be real. I mean, it really... We are somehow in this web of life that is bigger than we are. And so I just think whatever kind of forgiveness we might throw out there is going to go somewhere good, you know, help somehow. I mean, sometimes people have terrible things they have to try to forgive. And if you can't do it, maybe just to say, I can't do it, but please rework it somehow for me, you know, somehow putting it out there anyway. You can't expect everything to get neatly tied up at the end, but you do the best you can. The other wonderful thing about these four things that Ira Byatt has pointed out is this is not just death work.
Yeah,
this is everyday life work for a full, abundant life, as Barbara was talking about this morning.
Yeah. And with all four of those, I mean, when you're dealing with a dying person, or you're the dying person, saying those things yourself to them, often, regardless whether you're the dying person or the other one, that often stimulates the other person to do it. I mean, in your father's case, the I love you, he doesn't respond that way, but, you know, in the next conversation, you know, you're really special to me, you meant a lot. I mean, you may find other words than love to say the same thing, but when I know when somebody, if you thank somebody, whether they're dying or you're dying, you thank them for something, they want, well, yeah, I want to thank you for this too, and it, it helps them, even helps the other person when you say one of them.
You're absolutely right. Each one of those is a is an opening back and forth, right? And so these are words when someone is dying that you might need to say to them, and when you are dying that you may need to say to others. So just to remember that this is something, these are things to remember all the way along the way, and particularly critical when you feel that this may be your last chance to do so. Yes,
and in terms of the other person's response, sometimes perhaps it's okay for us to recognize that in their own nature, in terms of where they are, like your father. I had a mother like that. She always did what was best for us and sometimes was pretty critical about it. But I meant it for your good.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes we have to accept, see their acceptance as their response, even if they can't say the words of it.
I think in our lives we have to do an awful lot of translation, a lot of interpretation. And we, just like translators sometimes translate a word incorrectly, or we sometimes do that. And to try to get back to, I mean, like I was thinking in a Bible study this morning about the Greek and the Hebrew and getting back to the original meaning and, you know, and how it gets translated and over time. And part of our task in our lives is to translate as best we can the language of the other person, the message of the other person that we might have said differently. We might have shown differently. And yet if you can see what may have been behind that, it can help a great deal.
So I've been trying to imagine myself doing this with my parents.
Good. Think really particular, that's really good.
And because you never know when they might die, they live, you know, half the country away from me. I'm struggling with how do I, if I want to do this before I know they're dying sometime, how would I approach that? Because if I started talking to my dad on the phone, but he like, do you know something that I don't know?
About me or about you?
In an end-of-life situation.
Yeah. Depends entirely on your relationship with your dad. Okay, so you might decide, I would like to write a letter to him and just say, I was at this session, or this got raised in my life. It has nothing to do with anybody's health at the moment, so it's not threatening. But I really want to say these things to you and then amplify, you know. So that might be one way.
Okay.
It would be, if you do have the chance, you know, now that you maybe know about these things or think they might be things you'd want to say or take the opportunity, look, you know, those little opportunities will come, and they don't all have to be said at once. It doesn't have to be formal. Although, there is nothing wrong with saying, sit down and pay attention to me. I need and want to say these things to you, and I don't know if the time is going to just pop up. Okay, so I would encourage you, just first of all, you know, just sort of look for opportunities. But when, if those don't happen or aren't likely to happen, if they're half a country away and you don't see them that often, then maybe you need to either write them or make an appointment, or you know. For this. I mean, this is what this woman, this dying woman did, was, I mean, she made an appointment. She made a space for this to happen. And she was very intentional about that. And it was, as I said, a great gift to her family to do that.
My mother had Alzheimer's. And the picture's totally different.
Yeah. So how might you have been able to say these things to her?
Well,
in that,
you know,
context?
I just lived them.
Okay.
She was dying through a summer,
mm-hmm.
and I saw her every day. I'm mm-hmm. a teacher, and I was retired, so I spent mm-hmm. time with her mm-hmm. every day and mm-hmm. told her I loved her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she would just come up with things out of the blue,
mm-hmm.
and let's go on a picnic. Okay, and so at the nursing home, I talked to the staff, and we ate out in the patio and stuff. But it was really, really hard. And then she was really declining at the beginning of the summer. And we had volunteered for 3 weeks at Holden, and coming at the end of July and August. And we decided that if she died while we were gone, we would not come back. I told her, you know, what was going on and everything, and she, just before we left, the nurses warned me that they thought she was going.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to her, and you know, but I did not give her permission.
Mm-hmm.
And when we came back, we weren't back too long when I got the call from the nursing home that said, I don't think she's going to live through the night.
Mm-hmm.
I prayed about it, and I decided not to go. And I thought, you know, I called her back the last time, and I don't want to do that again.
Okay.
I had given my permission. We, you know, talked about it, and so I just thought they will cover it. They were very loving, and I think that was, still think that was the right decision.
So you
but know. It was not easy.
Okay.
But she didn't know.
No, she really didn't know. So it was for me, not for her.
You have to make the decision that you think is the best one, and what was best for you might not have been the best for somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. I knew she would not be alone. She
mm-hmm.
was surrounded by people who
mm-hmm.
loved her.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm an only child,
mm-hmm.
and our kids lived in different parts. Mm-hmm. And so,
can I just probe that a little bit more about why you felt that you know, so you prayed about it and you decided for you wouldn't go. I mean, you'd done your permission giving, your goodbye. So I understand that. But what was it in particular about not being at her death that you felt would be better for you?
Well, just before we came to Holden, we
uh-huh.
went through the same thing. And I talked to her, and at that point, I was not ready for
right.
her to go.
Right.
And so I sort of, you know, said, Mom, you've got a lot of life to live. And
okay.
we talked and everything.
Okay.
And I think I was sort of afraid that I might call her back again, and she needed to go.
Oh, okay. So then it wasn't just for you.
No. Because she was just existing.
I mean, it could have been just for you. That's fine. I mean, you can do that. But if you So you understood, in a sense, that the more loving thing to do was to let her go once you'd sort of made that,
yeah,
that step. Okay.
It's quite an experience walking with somebody that has Alzheimer's.
It's really hard. And because of the way we live now and the opportunities for longer life, more and more of us have that opportunity to walk with someone who is mentally diminished. Yeah.
This is not for my mother, but I lead worship in a nursing home once a week. And the former principal from our kid's school was dying of Alzheimer's. And members of our church were taking turns sitting with his wife. And I was there when he died.
Mm.
And his wife said, "Do you have a Bible?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Would you read Psalm 91?
Mm.
And there were nurses around him and everything, and they'd indicated that he was just about not ready to die. And I started to read, and the nurses said, "He's gone." Jean said, "Keep reading." So I kept reading. And he got alert, listened through to the end of the psalm, and then he just took a deep breath and was gone.
My goodness, well, would that would be the case for many of us, huh? Wonderful that
but
you could be there for that.
A privilege.
Yeah,
to be there
privilege.
For
it's
that.
A great honor. It's a great honor. Speaking of Alzheimer's, I just want to tell you one story about my chaplaincy work, which was we had a nursing home attached to the hospital. And one of the things that we started to do was to have a Tuesday, 2 o'clock prayer group of the patients, or anyone who wanted to be part of that. It was the most wonderful and hilarious hour of my week. and touching. I mean, not always hilarious, but I mean, it's just a wonderful sense of. And I'm thinking about one of the things that when you become incapacitated, you know, your work can be prayer. Your work can be prayer. And those people were definitely prayers in many ways, you know, many interrupted sorts of ways, but still, and it struck me that, you know, they had work to do yet. And as you look at this sheet on the back, I would invite you actually to look at some of these, because I think it's really the task work at the end of life is different than at other times in our life to some extent. But even though these things obtain throughout, you know, just regular life. But I found just the titling a little bit weird. So on some of those copies, I have changed landmarks to goal. I think that's a little clearer. And task work to sort of getting there, getting to the goal. And that helped me understand this graph or this list a little bit more. The goal at the end of your life would be to have a sense of completion of your worldly affairs, and then the task work that accompanies that, or the getting there part, is taking care of all that worldly stuff, your transfer of property, your will, your handing off of being president of the church council, or whatever it is, that, you know, whatever needs to be handed off to other people, that sense is end of life work. A sense of completion in relationships with community. So those are, you know, you might want to be writing a lot of notes. Or setting up a lot of coffee hours with, you know, have coffee with people that you just want to be sure that you've closed it off. And those kinds of, this is a longer, this is end of life, but some of these things, of course, happen in retirement, or, you know, when you change change communities, you move or whatever, but at other, these transitional points, but they are also things that you have, you want to leave your life with a sense of completion about them. Expressions of regret, I mean, there are things we regret that we didn't take an opportunity, or we overlooked someone, or we should have picked up on an idea someone had that we quashed, or I don't know what it might be, but things that you wish you hadn't done that aren't necessarily things you need to ask for forgiveness for, perhaps, but to acknowledge that, you know, not everything went, you know, you look back and you wish you'd done some things differently. This is kind of, this list is sort of an explication of some of this work, I think, is what this list is. Having a sense of meaning about your own life. I can't tell you how important that is, that I found that to be as a chaplain with people, that one of the things that was the probably the single most important thing that I could offer to people was to just be there to hear stories or invite stories about, I mean, things that people might not have necessarily thought were particularly important, but just were memories, and then to be able to say, to just ask a question or two about, you know, well, why is it that you remember that so well? Or what effect did that have on the rest of your life that happened, you know? Trying to help people have a way of framing and giving some meaning to what their life has held. You'll find people, if you can, you know, doing the scrapbooking, which has been such a kind of amazing recent phenomenon that people get really into, but you can at least to really take the time to look over your life. It's usually overwhelming. I mean, Barbara said she was the hoarder, and this morning, you know, our basement just is full of papers and pictures and boxes of keepsakes. And, but anyway.
Pictures are a wonderful entrance into a confused mind of somebody.
Very good. So even when someone is mentally incapacitated, a picture may provoke a memory, or you may be able to at least enter into the emotion of that moment. I think I mentioned this earlier this week, that entering into the emotion of the person, whether it's an actual memory or not, or an actual event, is one way of accompanying in a very meaningful way that person as they travel this journey.
When I was with my grandmother, it was towards the end of her life. And I recall, I was in college or post-college, visited her a few times a week, and she would recall things like with her mother and her father, and she would act like she was there again. Is that reliable, or is that just, so I was less curious about it then than I would be now.
Whether the memory was accurate, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that,
how accurate are your memories?
How do you receive that? Well, those real primal things where you were screaming at or for your mom or your dad or you feel, yeah, I think those primal emotional things, I think they're pretty accurate. I don't know why I think
I think the emotional truth of the memory is probably real, that there's an emotional truth there.
Yeah, the calling out for mama. I mean, she must have felt like mama was there and would respond.
Right.
So just that emotional thing.
Our memories are something. I mean, they are, you know, there are people who will swear at that something happened that, you know, that didn't. I mean, I know when I remember things from my childhood, my sister always looks at me and says, "What?" You know? Either she'll say, "Well, you remember a lot of different things than I do," or else she doesn't quite say, "You're full of beans." That didn't happen. But our memories are great. I mean, they are not, even an inaccurate memory, even an altered memory, even a, what you are doing is you are making meaning out of an event of some sort that needs to be recalled. And so I hardly ever worry too much unless there's some particular reason I have to find out the facticity of an event. I don't usually worry too much about whether it's fact or not, accurate or not, but I do listen to the way the story's told, what meaning it seems to have for the person, what it's meant then, what it means now, why are you remembering it now, you know, what brought that up, you know, what were you feeling, what's going on right now that reminded you of that, or I don't know, that way of using the stories. Yes?
Yeah, sometimes the impact of the memory is different for some than for others, and that makes a big difference. Some people can be at the same place and you can remember because it impacted you, but it just
sure.
impacted the
right.
other person.
Sure.
And there,
yeah.
that is
yeah.
a difference.
Others were in the story, but they were different characters in the story than you were.
She had some family pictures on the wall, and I just remember, like, she would make up who they were.
Okay, well,
I mean,
yeah,
it was just like.
Yeah. And what would you do when that happened? Would you correct her?
I just listened. I think I was so, you know, I was like 24. I was just like, I don't know. I just kind of, like, observed it. It
yeah.
was just kind of weird. And you know, but I really remember it. It was just like.
I remember one really painful moment. This old man had come into the hospital, and he had obviously had a stroke. There was something that had happened that had affected his memory terribly, and he was telling things, and his daughter was sitting at the side of his bed, and she was just rambling, "Daddy, that didn't happen. Daddy, we're here in the hospital." And she was so unable to be able to say, to go with him where he was. Rather, she wanted him to be where she was. that it was really painful to watch that was unable to be bridged. At least at that moment, maybe she grew and maybe he got a lot better, and maybe she grew and was able over time to meet again. But that was so difficult. He was trying to communicate. He was telling something, and she was saying, "No, no, no, you're wrong." It's very hard. Yeah.
I heard a real good explanation from a nurse who worked with patients of these kinds of imaginary memories, and she says, "Don't worry about it. Go with the people, with them. This is God's anesthetic."
Huh.
I thought that was a beautiful way of saying
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to collude. You don't have to start to add details yourself, necessarily. Although sometimes that's fun.
You know, you're talking about, the people we're talking about are basically Christian people. Tell us about how you deal with people who are really frightened of dying.
Frightened of dying. You don't have to not be a Christian to be frightened of dying.
Well, I know, yeah. But you know what I mean. We
where there's not a sense of something else
right.
that's going to come. That's interesting. I guess death, in a way, is a great leveler. And it's all unknown. I mean, we really all are stepping into the unknown, whether you're a person of faith or not. And the people who have been most, I think I said earlier in the week that I found it easier to be with, or that people generally who had a faith were able to die there was, I think there was just a sense, more of a sense of the of joy, and you know, that there was one of the things is the idea that there would be a reunion, and I think that comes in so much at the end that one can't. One of the great things that we're offered in our understanding of resurrection is at least something like a reunion. a great being together again in God. And so that, I think, is a great comfort at the end of life. And the fact that you have this experience often where people are seeing people who've already died tend to be visions of that that come to them, and they may be speaking about them. And that has probably increased some of that understanding of what it must be like after death, you know, that you're being met by those you loved or something. So I guess I would say there is a difference in kind of a level of what joy or what the future holds there. But on the other hand, because we are all really stepping into the unknown anyway, we are acknowledging that we don't really know what happens after death.
We have these Elizabeth Kubler-Ross near-death experiences where people have come back to life and reported they saw a light,
yeah,
a tunnel.
Yeah.
And it's uncanny that the stories all
say
the same thing.
Yeah, right. It is. And I think we have to remember is that those are near-death experiences, mm-hmm, that people didn't die.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we don't know if that's a different experience than dying. But still, there is that commonality that seems to be there. And so I guess to answer your question is I think that when people are surrounded by people who love them, who appreciate that they lived, that it's almost good enough. It's not enough for me.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that their deaths are anguished necessarily with fear.
If I'm being driven to go see a movie, and I've looked up the movie and I know what it's about, I know the characters and everything, I'm happy to go. But if someone is putting me in the car and saying, "We're going," and I'm saying, "What, are we going on a trip or what?" Don't ask, we're just going. I'm likely to be very fearful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I can say, I am happy that I'm in the car, I am happy that we've begun the journey.
Yeah.
I'm happy now that we're on the road.
Yeah.
Then I'm not concerned about what's coming next. And then it doesn't matter if
yeah.
I have faith that there's something beyond.
Yeah, right. And so to have that companionship, you're happy in that companionship, it might make it that easy. I think those are all good points. We're actually coming to our end, and I want to just say that recognizing that there's still work to be done when someone is dying, that they have work to do, spiritual work, about what their life meant, repairing relationships, having a chance to say goodbye, having a chance to reconcile as well as they can is significant. And I just hope that each of you have that chance to make that time as much as you can. And if you are with people, to help them do that as they go forward. I would also like to invite you as we go to take some of these extra copies of things that I have here. This was a copy of the prayer commendation service that we did, which comes from Susan Greel and Marty Haugen's book. It's called, it's called A Sacred Journey, Turn My Heart, A Sacred Journey from Brokenness to Healing, which we used earlier in the week. This was the syllabus for the week, and on the back are sort of a list of various questions that you might want to hold up for yourself or others. These are copies for advanced planning for funerals. You may want to take these. I don't want to take these out in the village because I would rather not have the weight. So please take them. You may want to, either if your church doesn't already have something like this, you may want to suggest that they do. You may want to take a few copies for you or your family. And then I have these samples of advanced directives. If you're not familiar with them, if you just want to see what some of the discussion is around those, these booklets have that, and this is a Vermont copy. As we go, could we just one more time think this prayer of diminishment and yet fullness that comes at the time of death. The be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still. Be.